Good morning. You're listening to KGNU Community Radio. This is Poco and Boco. I'm your host, Nikhil Mankekar.
And I'm Tracy Jones. Today we are interviewing Mr. Pedro Silva of First Congregational in Boulder, and we're going to discuss some exciting new programs that he's involved with.
Yeah, Pedro, thank you for coming on. Full disclosure, we, Human Relations Commission, funded this pilot, so I was involved in the funding of it. But you're going to talk to us about the Blind Cafe today and right. Your pilot, Dismantling Racism in the Dark. Talk a little bit, give a little intro to about what that is and how it all came about.
So the Blind Cafe itself is a pretty much a stable event in Boulder. It's a pop-up event, so it comes up ever so often. It was started by Brian Rochelot. He goes by Rosh. He's a local musician, and he basically connected with some people. He had this idea after spending some time at a cafe in the dark in Iceland. He had this idea to, when he came back to Boulder, to have an event. He thought it was going to be a one-time event, essentially, and he was going to have people from the blind community to be like blind ambassadors to lead people into the darkness. They're going to have a meal, he was going to play some music, and maybe it would be a one-time thing, but it stuck. And since then, it's been traveling around the nation and then keeps coming back. He lives in Boulder too, so he has the event just moving around, and it's really growing. But out of that experience, he learned some things in terms of how people interact when some of the visual stimulation is gone. And he had some people say that the first time they ever felt really comfortable with themselves in a group with other people and they just articulated or expressed themselves openly was being in the dark. And so he started to notice the potential for using the darkness as a social change tool, for lack of a better expression. And so he largely focused on blind awareness. And then he and I engaged because we have my wife in common. They grew up together.
Okay.
And we so happened to just move to Boulder at the same time. And so we kind of stayed in contact. And then when I started doing some Dismantling Racism events, I had him play music at those events because I feel like sometimes music is can be disarming, you know. Mm-hmm. And so if people feel unsafe having discussions about things like race and other things that some people have a challenge with, then I thought it'd be good to have music there. And so I invited Rosh to participate. Then we did another program later where we brought in a mindfulness meditation person who focuses on teaching white people how to meditate and come in contact with privilege or racism and things like that. And she focused specifically on white people simply because she used to do mixed groups. And when the people would emerge out of the meditation, they would have two different experiences. Typically speaking, a person who identifies as white may come up and say, wow, I feel some guilt or I feel some other things that are happening right now. And the people of color may be feeling like I'm feeling some kind of pain from what I have experienced as I reflect on them. And they're supposed to then work with those things. But when they encountered each other emerging from that, it would kind of aggravate things because maybe the person of color may speak with some passion and the person identified as white may have a challenge hearing that while they're feeling guilt, or the person who identifies as white may want the person to help them feel a little bit better about themselves, which is in their position to do. So she said, you know what, I'm just going to focus on this side. So we brought her in. I did the Dismantling Racism piece. She did the mindfulness meditation piece. Rosh did the music. And then we said, you know what, we really need to take this into the dark. You know, we need to take this experience into the dark and see what comes up then, because we know that social conditioning kind of prevents people from engaging at some levels, and you have to do a lot of work to get people to open up. Mm-hmm. And by the time you get them to open up, sometimes the event's over.
Right.
You know, and so we thought, well, maybe if we could get people in the dark, maybe we'd be able to connect in a different way and remove the social conditioning that comes with the visual stimulation. And so we talked about it for a couple of years, and then finally we decided to make it happen. And then we reached out to the HRC and and because we wanted to make it accessible to people.
Yeah.
And we did it, and we're going to continue to refine it over time. We're about to send out some surveys to the participants to figure out where we can improve and how we can expand it. And we did a beta test with a few people, and then we did two pilots, and we're okay. in the process of reviewing those right now.
Nice. And you did this all just happened last month.
Yep. Last month it happened at E-Town.
E-Town. Excellent. About how many attendees did you have with these sessions?
We had, besides the facilitators, we had 13 people in the Saturday and the Sunday one each. And then we intentionally only brought in like 3 people on the first beta test. Essentially because we wanted to find out if people started feeling scared in the dark while they were having these conversations and wanted to get out there in total darkness. Mm-hmm. We wanted to, check in with how does it feel to answer these types of questions in this type of environment. And then if they said, yes, yeah, freaking me out, then we'd have to be able to adjust. And we didn't want to have more people in the room under those conditions. And so, but we learned a lot. And so we feel that we can continue to kind of grow with it.
So what are some of the things that came up in those discussions? Was it a guided discussion or was it free form?
It was guided.
And what are some of the things you guys talked about?
So initially we had people get present with their feelings because they were in the dark, they were in a vulnerable situation. We wanted them to be able to have space to acknowledge it if there was any anxiety, mm-hmm. to get that out of the room or into the room as soon as possible. And then we had a little bit of music just to kind of soothe the space after people talked about whatever anxiety they might feel. Then we went through what I call a confessional type of exercise where we would say, raise your hand if, and no one can see them, but the person's body has the experience of acknowledging, so if you say like, raise your hand if you laugh at racist jokes, even though you don't want to, and then the person would raise their hand, or we assume they raise their hand. We don't know what they did because we can't see them, but they had the experience of embodying a confessional space of saying whether it's between them and the darkness, but we invited them to do that. Once people went through that, we asked them, what did it feel like, and had them talk about that. And then we went through some other questions, and then we had people kind of share their stories. Mm. And then people would just speak and say, well, what emerged for me is this. And then as people shared their stories, we would acknowledge that, we hear you and we're with you. Mm. And so whatever they brought up, we would let them know, because they can't see anybody. So we let them know, we hear you and we're also with you. Not just with you, not meaning we necessarily agree, but communally we're holding this space with you as you explore this. And so there was an individual element and a communal element. And the really cool thing about it is that, at least from my perspective, is that the people get to have this total embodied experience of being uncomfortable, of being vulnerable, all the things that prevent people from engaging different sometimes, but they had it in a relatively safe environment. Their body can't tell the difference. So the ideal is if they ever go out into the world and they have an encounter that would be awkward or uncomfortable or something like that, their body will have already been like, this somehow is familiar, to me. And I don't know why, but I feel like I'm gonna admit something here. I feel like I'm gonna confess here. I feel like I'm gonna allow myself to be vulnerable here. And that's the intent. And if we could develop it in a way that people either did it as a practice or, there's a lot of different directions we could go with it. But the ideal is to have people embody that discomfort and then be able to use it when they're out in the world.
To work through that discomfort.
Right. So it's like you're doing the mindfulness practice and getting people in touch with that embodied experience through having the discomfort and all the feelings associated with it. And you said, so it begins individually and communally. Right. And then the hope is that becomes a kind of a teaching tool for them to be able to access this skill set as they go out in the public.
Exactly.
And so, in what ways would you say this... for you, do you see an improvement over, say, the traditional dismantling racism you did and some of the benefits of doing it this way in the dark that may have enhanced that?
The number one thing is access to how quickly people access their vulnerability. So I operate from the paradigm that we're all always vulnerable, but different people have a degree to which they can deceive themselves of their vulnerability based on different things. It could be social status, it could be wealth, it could be, you know, access to resources, whatever the case it may be. They can mask their vulnerability and build a ideological prison around themselves just to hide their own vulnerability.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's why I think a lot of times people are not willing to engage deeply on some of these topics, and particularly race in this country, because I mean, if you acknowledge race in this country from any depth and from a place of vulnerability, it's not a far stretch to realize, like, okay, no matter where you find yourself, it's built on a system of injustice and a system of oppression and all these things. Like, everyone knows that, even in people say, like, the crazy bootstrap statements that people make, they, on some level, they know, and they continue to build this wall around their knowledge or their awareness simply because, and this is my opinion, but I feel like they do that because it makes them come in contact with their own vulnerability. But when you come in a situation like this, like the Blind Cafe, Dismantling Racism in the Dark experience, as soon as you get to the door, you're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no denying that.
It's a disruption of that.
Right.
Before they head into the space.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's a really brilliant idea and a way to move forward with this conversation and the issues that we have on race in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the traditional ways have not seemed to yield much production or many answers. So I applaud you guys for coming up with a new idea to approach this difficult subject.
Yeah, and one of the things that was brilliant is that, you know, Rosh has been doing this for like 8 years. Like, he knows the darkness. He knows what it takes for people to feel safe in the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he's aware that they're going to encounter things. Mm-hmm. A number of people are going to encounter things that they wouldn't encounter normally.
Mm-hmm.
And another equalizer of it, to use that term lightly, is with the blind ambassadors who lead us into the darkness. You have to trust a person who you're going into their space. Like, they navigate the darkness, or to some degree, all the time.
Yeah.
So they're more of the masters of that realm. And you have to, from the beginning, you have to put your hand on the shoulder of the blind ambassador, and then someone else puts someone else's hand on another person's shoulder. And so you're automatically connected.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go into that darkness and you don't stay connected, you're going to not know where you are.
Mm.
You know, and there's a little bit of a little windy entrance when you first go in, so you become disoriented really quickly.
Mm.
And then even if you've seen the room in the light, you become disoriented quickly after going through the little bit of the windiness. And then you find yourself at a table, and you have to, you know, touch the tables, and we set the tables up so that people can feel and go, okay, get some sense of stability. And so they have to go through that whole process with other people. They can hear sounds and things like that, but it's just kind of disorienting, but they know they're vulnerable. And then what I learned, and I hope to apply to other things that I do, and I think the Brené Brown's work on vulnerability probably gets to it as well. But the quicker you can get the vulnerability, the quicker you can get the trust, the quicker you can get the authenticity, the quicker you can get to engagement. And that was very deeply embodied in our experience together that day, those days.
You are listening to POCO and BOCO, People of Color in Boulder County. I'm Tracy Jones.
And I'm also your host, Nikhil Mankeko. Today's guest is Pedro Silva, the minister at First Congregational Church, and he's here talking about The Blind Cafe, Dismantling Racism in the Dark, a new pilot he launched with his team last month. And, you know, Pedro, I have to say, when people think of the name Blind Cafe and then they tie it in with dismantling racism, I think a lot of people's minds immediately go to some idea of color blindness, or okay, I'm just not seeing race, and we're going to see what this is like. But that's not at all what you just described. And in fact, doing this kind of Blind Cafe experience, you know, as you said, it seems more of a way of getting people in touch with emotions, feelings, you know, almost like dismantling white fragility in some sense, to allow them to engage it, as you said, in an authentic way with this topic. What would you say, what do you hope to see in the future for this project?
Well, in the if I had the resources, I would probably create a space that where people could come and just dedicate themselves to a practice with this intent, knowing that no matter where they come from, whether they're black or white or Hispanic, whatever their situation is, that they can go into this space of intentional vulnerability, allow themselves to be with those feelings with other people who are also vulnerable, intentionally and consciously vulnerable, realizing that it's through trusting one another that we'll be able to create a greater sense of community, you know? And so if, but people, I think ultimately you need a practice of some sort to maintain this. I think that the one-off is, it's a good introduction. It's a good opportunity for people to become aware. And if they decide to go with that and, you know, discuss what they've learned with other people, they can probably build on it. And, but if in the ideal world, people would probably commit to a certain number of sessions to kind of establish a practice, and then they can just use that, you know, eventually take it off on their own and do whatever they want to do with it. But that would be the ideal, is that people would take this setup, and we would refine it to a point where we've kind of mastered it, and then we can distribute it to people as a program that they can create for themselves as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you plan to do additional sessions.
Right. We're going to do more pilots. And right now the Blind Cafe itself is a pop-up experience. So that means it just pops up every, you know, different times. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it'll be tied to the pop whenever the Blind Cafe pops up. But then ideally we'll have some standalone sessions that people will be able to participate in as we refine it. And then eventually, you know, maybe schools or hospitals or companies and things like that may want to have a program and other people can facilitate it. It won't just have to be me and Rosh. Mm-hmm. We can just set up the program, say, this is how you do it, this is how you set it up, and they can, you know, do that, set that up and take it somewhere.
So with it being a pop-up, how do people find out where it's popping up?
Well, that really right now depends on the Blind Cafe's schedule. And it, because it's a pop-up, it's just like you find out however long in advance, and then people buy tickets for the normal session. We're going to have to figure out how we make it free for people as we do the pilot in the future. So we'll work with that with maybe other members of the community to establish that. And then once it becomes something more established, we'll be able to do it with a more routine basis.
Interesting.
You know, or have some people facilitate it, if not even us.
So in general, people's reaction has been...
Yeah, positive.
Very positive.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's not just about... Because ultimately, from my perspective, and I think from Rosh's as well, and other people who participated, that we are vulnerable and we came in contact with that awareness in that space, anybody can go in there, and unless they have like some kind of vision that makes them see in the dark, and then maybe they're not vulnerable, but everyone else in there is vulnerable, and so anybody can apply to, it can apply to anyone.
What kind of feedback did you get, both immediately and then say in the weeks following? Did you get any from some of these participants in the pilot?
Yeah, some people said talked about how once they were aware of their own vulnerability, they were able to share, and they knew that some people said, well, I'm sharing and not seeing a person's facial expression keeps me going with the story, because like sometimes they may get ready to tell a story and then they might think, oh, I see this person's face, maybe I should adjust what I'm saying right now. Yeah. And not having that visual response, it's like, okay, well, all I can do is just go with the story and speak it into the room, you know? And it was really interesting. And one of the blind ambassadors we flew in from Atlanta, normally we probably wouldn't have, flown him in, but he's African-American and he's blind. He didn't become blind until he was 13. So he had sighted experience for a certain number of time. And then he brought up, he was very critical to the space, and also just being able to acknowledge his own experience with race, and also now not being able to see people who may or may not have any kind of prejudice towards him, whereas before he would be able to see it. And also the question for himself is like, is he blind first or black first? Because people have issues when they come across a person that's blind. They sometimes have their own things that come up because they just don't know how to be around a person that is blind. And there was a lot of interesting things that came out of the conversation just with all of us, but it was very very rewarding. I felt like.
Did you establish any ties with that initial group that would make them want to, as you said, do follow up events, or you know, will they be coming to other events around these issues that you host?
We have their email addresses, so we'd be more we'd definitely invite them to the next ones that come up. We had someone that came to both of the pilots.
Yeah.
Like they came to one and then they said, you know what, I'm going to come back tomorrow because I just want to go a little deeper with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty cool to see that someone was willing to do that. And we had one guideline that we don't share other people's learnings unless we ask them first.
Yeah.
So people can learn things and we can say what we learned from it. And if they gave us permission, then we could say, yeah, well, someone shared that they learned this. So, there's another layer of safety there. And you can't see afterwards. I didn't know who told the story anyway. It's like, oh, the person said, oh, that was me that said that story. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah. I had no way of knowing.
That's good. I mean, this topic on, you know, discussions and different work that I've done, leading discussions on racism and privilege and trying to get people to engage. I mean, I've always been an advocate of we have to do something differently to get people past these defenses. It's so easy for them to go up that just, you know, we'll bring a discussion, a session to a standstill.
Right.
But this idea of disrupting some aspect of people's daily lives or senses to make them vulnerable and make them more open to engaging, I think is excellent and needed.
Yeah.
One thing is, so a lot of this is you're bringing in embodied mindfulness practice. And so Boulder's an interesting place in that it's full of kind of people of color who say hidden racism that is not acknowledged.
Right.
And at the same time, it is like a central food, you know, a hub of supposedly of mindfulness practice with the traditions that have been established in the city. I don't know if you have any thoughts. I mean, on just why with so many people practicing mindfulness, I've often found it a kind of mental gymnastics that can help people put up a shield as opposed to engaging in it in the way I think it's supposed to, which is to make you more vulnerable and authentic.
Well, my thoughts on it are that, you know, a lot of people, they use mindfulness unintentionally. It's to make them feel better.
Like an escape.
Mm-hmm. So, and when your desire is to feel better, then anything that makes you feel not well is automatically something that needs to be shunned and needs to be pushed to the side. So if you sit on the mat, and that's why I really respect the work of Kara Dansky, who led the mindfulness element of one of our sessions, is she was a lawyer already working in the kind of civil rights space, but also was a Shambhala, you know, trained meditation teacher and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when she started bringing the two things together, she said, you know what, I can't just have this be on the mat and be like, oh, I'm, you know, everyone's wonderful, I'm one with the universe, and then, you know, I got to bring this all together and make it embodied. And that's why she's teaching that to people. But a lot of us, we just want to feel better. And when you want to feel better, you know, you don't, when you encounter somebody that reminds you that you still got a lot of work to do, that's like a psychological threat.
You know
what I mean?
I believe that's why so many people become so defensive. My grandmother used to say, baby, you can't put a Band-Aid on a bullet wound and call it good.
Yeah.
Right.
So when we're bringing up these deep, sensitive, powerful issues, I would like to challenge those people that are not of color to not take it as a personal attack. We are pointing out experiences that we've had.
Right.
And your mouth says that you want to deal with it, but your actions are saying, nope, shut down. shut down. Mm-hmm. And we have to come. I'm so excited about this program because we need to have innovative ways for people to be able to look at themselves without the whole defensiveness. Oftentimes you bring up a discussion or you bring up an action that was done toward you that didn't make you feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And people just either A, shut down, or one of my least favorites, say, well, I don't even see color. What are you talking about? Like, it's frustrating, to say the least, especially when we're trying to move forward and make positive change. We got to get on the team, people. Yeah. We got to look at ourselves.
Well, I think finding ways to, I mean, and with the Buddhist influence, I mean, I think the authentic Buddhist teaching is to engage in suffering. It's not it's not just to run away from it. It's not just to acknowledge it and then try to meditate your way out of it. It's to actually, it's the practice is a way of going to it and going into it. And that creates a unique experience in so many ways, embodied and disembodied. And so what you're doing is actually in tune with, I think, authentic mindfulness practice. So I'm really happy to see some of that popping up. I think with all the new age books we have locally, it can get lost in all that fog.
Yeah, one of the things, the fundamental question of our of us creating that space was, if racism is, you know, the belief that people of different colors or different, you know, races are inferior or whatever the case may be, does that disappear in the darkness? Can racism actually exist in the dark? Because if you can't see the person, where's the racism go? If the person's not, if you can't see the person but the racism still exists, then it's inside of you. You know what I mean? And it goes both ways, even prejudice. You know, if a person assumes that a person, a white person's prejudiced, and then they can't see the white person, and the prejudice feeling is still there, or the fear of being prejudiced is there, then that also has to be acknowledged. So it always takes the person back to themselves and to the community, because it's a engagement thing, and we can't move beyond it because we're all vulnerable to it. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. That's like where Dr. King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. It's not just socially, it's also internally. Yeah. Like the internal injustice is a threat to justice within one's own inner being and in their engagements with other human beings.
Absolutely. Well, Pedro, always great to have you on. Thank you so much for doing this, launching this pilot. I'm really excited to see, will you take it? And thank you for being on. You're listening to Poco and Boco, People of Color in Boulder County. Today's guest was Pedro Silva, minister at First Congregational Church, and running the Blind Cafe, Dismantling Racism in the Dark. I am your host, Nikhil Mankekar.
And I am Tracy Jones. We thank you very much for listening and tuning in.